Tito, I hardly know where to begin in an interview with you. I love your work. I have all your books. I very much admire you as a poet. I think that there's a real tenderness and gentleness and magical quality to your work. I think it's very careful and thoughtful. The one thing I wonder about you is that you seem to just be an effortless poet. Your poems seem so effortless, but I know they're not.
No.
Can you just tell me about your writing process?
Oh, I can, but it's going to be an eclectic explanation.
That's kind.
I mean this sincerely, I don't know how we describe this to each other, but every single one of my poems, I think, I've done in a different manner. I don't think there's any singular way of doing this. And some of them go through long, long editing processes, and some are just right there. But they, in the end, have to ring true. They have to be just what you were describing, and they've got to feel that way to me. And reading aloud is the third half of a poem, so I certainly, try to do that and make sure that they make sense in the mouth as much as to the ear.
When you start a poem, do you write on a computer, on a typewriter, or do you write longhand?
All of those.
Wow.
I really think, it's just the tool is not the thing, ultimately. So how I do it and where it comes from in that nascent stage, those first beginning few words that start to push you forward, I don't know where they happen. They happen everywhere. They happen anywhere I can jot them down, or if they haunt me. Sometimes it's just words that keep coming back and won't go away, and that's a good thing.
Have you ever recorded a poem and then written it down?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I don't know that I have done that, but I'm guessing I have through the years, because I think sometimes when I give talks or if I'm giving a reading, I'll launch into something. I don't know where it came from. And then if somebody has made a copy of that, a recording or something, I'll listen to it and go, what was I doing? It was a good thing. It is the work itself kind of coming alive in a moment that most surprises me.
And there you have a particular poem, and it's one of my favorite poems that you've written. And I think it's called The City Within?
Yes.
The City is Inside Us.
The City is Inside Us.
Yeah.
I love that poem.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how that poem came about?
I can in the sense that I talk a lot to kids. And one of the hardest things is explaining the subjective to kids and how to value what they feel versus what they are instructed to value, what they are instructed to feel. And so when I was doing this, one of the things I always try to do is pick a kid out and have him or her imagine a baseball bat. And everybody knows what the kid's imagining, and the kid's imagining a baseball bat. Then I put my arms out, and I say, this is about how big a baseball bat is. How are you imagining it in a head that's this big? And I put my hands
great.
Around his head. How do you do that? It's magic. And what it means is somewhere inside of you is all of this stuff. And it's the imagination that brings it up. It's like some great librarian inside of yourself who looks everything up and brings it forward when you need it. And as I was talking about that, for some time, I started to think about what we keep inside and, that great piece of luggage that we are. We carry it all.
But that whole extended metaphor that we're a city and how you just make it work.
Well, there's another poem that speaks to that in a curious way. Let me just get the one line. I'm going to get the one little stanza. This is in some extensions on the sovereignty of science. And this actually led to the other poem. And here's the few lines. The reason you can't lose weight later on in life is simple enough. It's because of how so many people you know have died, and that you carry a little of each of them with you. So we can't lose
That's
weight.
Nice.
We carry them with us. And as I began to think about that, a lot of people, and a lot of people are a town, they become a city of, the more people you know. And that's where the metaphor.
We have in front of us a copy of The Dangerous Shirt, your latest book with Copper Canyon, which is a beautiful book. And thinking of that poem, In Night, where you're talking about looking at the stars and the lights from the stars, yeah, when it's not really there because they were there a billion years ago.
Right.
And you seem to make these references to cosmology occasionally in physics. And do you find that physics, science itself, is a source of inspiration for you?
Absolutely, but, you know, I think science may be our best way of understanding the world, but it may not be our best way of living in it. Yeah. And so I'm
You say that in a poem, don't you?
I may say something like that.
Yeah.
I always am working with this notion of cultural science or science of the moment. You know, science generalizes, and yet we are individuals. We are the counterpoint to the generalization. And yet, are we less scientific? Are we less valid in our moment than a scientific law? And I'm always working with that dynamism, that juxtaposition of those two points of view, where the individual has got to count for something, and you just don't add them all up and take out what's inconvenient.
It's so interesting that you talk about the individual, but I think that the individual that you are and the individual that's in your poetry is really an individual that's a really part of a community, because I see mm-hmm. your work as a kind of work that builds and forms and lives off of community.
Yeah. I think that's central to it. I grew up that way, and I don't think anything I say has value without somebody else reading it. And so when I write, I'm writing in some, it springs from that sense of a collective of we're in this together. And it, some of it comes from growing up the way that I did, and my mother from England, my father from Mexico, and my first language being Spanish, and then turning pretty quickly into English, and how I've learned that in English, you know, the smallest thing, it's rugged individualism. I did this. I dropped the pen. I did it. And in Spanish, so that I dropped the pen, that's rugged individualism in its smallest moment. I did it. And that same moment in Spanish, and really the Romance languages and most languages around the world, except for something like English, that same moment would be something like, se me cayó la pluma, or the pen, it fell from me. We were both there. I mean, maybe I did, but maybe the pen did it, you know?
Right.
And that suggests the idea of the possibility of an inherent life in things, that we're not it by ourselves. We're in it together.
Nice.
So that instead of rugged individualism, that suggests a kind of rugged pluralism.
Right.
And I think that's where this idea of writing about community comes to me. It's not just writing about community. It's that when I write words on the paper, they're already about community, simply because it's a point of view that I think I have.
And the words that we use are given to us by a community.
I think they are.
It reminds me of the title poem, The Dangerous Shirt, which mm-hmm. is really kind of very humorous poem that this guy is like, I shouldn't put on that shirt, because if I put on that shirt, then I'm going to move, I'm going to get out of this
yep.
house, and I'm going to go
yep.
do stuff, and as yep. if the shirt has a life of its own, an energy of its own.
That's it.
As part from being a poet, you've also been a teacher for how many years?
30.
Oh, yeah, over 30? 30 years.
Yeah.
Yes.
So does that feed into your work, and how is teaching related to your work?
It's part and parcel. It's they're immediate handholders. You know, the wonderful thing about teaching is I always am having to explain or react to or keep alive every single day the idea of writing, why we do it, how we do it, when we do it, all of those things. I have to revisit them every day. And not only that, I have to reinvent it every semester. And that keeps me close to the basics, I think. I think that's an advantage when you're sitting down to write. And it also helps me from maybe not writing too esoterically, in the sense that I've got readers and they've got to understand.
Right.
In the sense that when I'm teaching, I've got things to say and they have to understand. And so when I teach, I think the clarity that necessitates is also something that comes around and applies to the writing when it's creative.
You teach at Arizona State University.
I do.
And I imagine that a lot of students have been influenced by you. I know some specifically that tell me they've been influenced by you, people like Rich Yanez and so many others. And have you been influenced by any of your students?
Oh, all the time. I mean, I think that's how it works. It's always reciprocal. I teach at the university, and that's true, but I came from the old Poets in the Schools program in the 70s. And so I've tried to stay with that so that whenever I teach, I go places as well, and I go all over the community to teach. And I write things in places that teach people. So that teaching becomes a pretty exciting and complex kind of thing. I'm glad I influence my students at the university, but I'm in so many ways more interested in the fourth grader that I used to be. You know, that I was sitting in that chair, and it's not people who are going to go forward and be writers, but they're going to think about what that writing offered them in that moment. They're going to keep that in their heart, and that's, I think, whatever they do, I'm glad that's part of it.
Yeah, we forget sometimes as writers that we really influence people on all kinds of levels.
It's true.
Because we were in a moment there in the room with them, and we saw them, and they saw us.
It's true.
But I have to say, you are one of my influences, and have been since I began writing poetry. And you've been a good teacher because of what you just said, that you communicate. But you don't write the kind of poetry that you just read once. It's clear. And yet so many of your poems are so profound that you go back to them. And I learn from you.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to say that you teach people, not just in the classroom.
That's very kind. That's right. I do believe what you're saying, by the way. I think that simplicity has to be girded by something that's going to give a reader a second and a third and a fourth reading, something to read, you know, that's different from the first reading. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about Arizona itself. Mm-hmm. Arizona recently has been in the Chicano news.
The world news. Really.
Yeah, with the banned books and that Libro Traficante and the perceptions that we have of Arizona are that it's a very hostile place at times for Latinos, for Mexicanos, for Chicanos.
Mm-hmm.
You were born in Arizona.
I was born on the border, yes.
And that is completely your landscape. And then you've been at ASU, which is in Tempe, Arizona, for over 30 years.
Yeah, and I was at University of Arizona in Tucson for 10.
Oh, wow.
I have been here.
So do you find it difficult, challenging at times to negotiate the social and cultural landscape?
Yes, of course, and it goes without saying, but it's not an everyday reality. And I think whatever the news reports, it's true. No question about it. But it is not true in the way that I think the news often presents it, which is difficult to read when you read something, a story that is ostensibly about you, but you're nowhere in it.
Right.
We report the loud, but we live the quiet, and there's, I'm sure, an answer that's somewhere in the middle. It's a hard place in so many ways. I don't know a different place, and that's an interesting thing for me. This is the struggle that has been here since the beginning when we used to get swatted for speaking Spanish. This is a 21st century version of that, what we're going through now. You know, all the labels are there and ready. But on any given day, it is a day like anywhere else, and you know I travel enough to know that. And the key is, you know, you speak up when you need to, and you have lunch when you have to.
and ASU has produced so many Chicano poets and fiction writers, and has one of the best Latino presses out there today, the Camino del Sol series. And that segues into the next question about Arizona that I have, that landscape, that desert landscape. I know driving from California to El Paso several times at night, the stars seem embedded into the sky. I mean, they're just so amazing over there. And then the landscape itself, the saguaro and the it must have a tremendous impact on the way you write poetry.
You know, it does, and it takes you many, many, many years to figure that out. I think, if I can just sort of say it this way, I think when I travel to big cities or, you know, when I'm near them, all the connections are there to be seen. A road works to get you from here to there, and a window lets you see out, and all the connections are made in a city. And in the desert, there are no ready-made connections. You have to figure it out for yourself. It's an act of the imagination.
Mm.
And I think that plays into the writing. in a big way, you have to forge new ways of thinking, because the city or whatever it is that I we're imagining as that more populated kind of approach, whatever we're thinking that offers us, it's not there when you're out alone. And I remember the first time I visited New York City, I was coming back on a subway late at night, coming back to my aunt's house. And when I got to the small subway station, the doors opened. And something inside of me told me, if you're ever going to be scared in New York City, this is the time to be scared. Because when I got out onto the platform, nobody was there. It was like a photographic negative for me in my life. Mm-hmm. In that, in the desert, if nobody's there, or you know, just in a rural setting, if nobody's there, that's good. That's how it is. And if somebody is there, if there's a crowd gathered, there's been a fight or an accident or a fire or something. And it was the opposite in New York City. If there was a crowd, that was okay. That's the way it was. And so it was like a reverse for me. And it took me, it was that moment that crystallized it for me. I just felt it.
We're talking to Alberto Alvaro Rios, whose latest book of poems is The Dangerous Shirt. You know, talking about landscape, you do write about the desert some, and you write more about the border or border psyche. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I don't read you as a desert poet. Mm-hmm. You write about the inner landscape of that place, about being a person who lives there. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting to me because I literally write about the desert mm-hmm. a lot. Mm-hmm. And I use that landscape, and you do less so. And I'm wondering why that is. Is it because you're more interested in the way that people work and the way that they feel and their complications, and that's more of an obsession for you than, for instance, the desert landscape itself?
No, I think I write a lot about the desert, but in fact quite a lot. But I think I also find ways to bring it into the mix and not simply isolate it as this is a poem about, you know, walking out in the Sonora Desert or
right.
something like that. I think it is integrated into relationships and people in a way that is, you know, a cheese sandwich. it's part of the day, but it's not all the day.
Right.
And so I think when I do it, I probably take that approach.
You know, I remember when I first got a copy of Pig Cookies, your collection of stories, mm-hmm. and I was kind of a new writer at the time. I had just decided I wanted to be a writer. And so I was discovering all these Chicano writers, and that became one of my favorite books. you know, you are known as being a Chicano writer, a Latino right. writer. If you know, if we start to name poets, your name's going to come up inevitably mm-hmm. very quickly. Mm-hmm. And your father was Mexican.
Yes.
But your mother was English. And I'm wondering, right. does that English cultural side come out in your work as well?
It gives me perspective because when I was growing up, around my father's family and with that language and that culture. And my mother was an outsider, so much that my brother and I didn't even call my mother mother at the time. We would call her Agnes, just like everybody
wow.
else, because she was, you know, an outsider. And it was clear even to kids. And we called another lady down the street. And we called her Mama because she used to give us the things we wanted, like Jell-O right out of the box, and we thought, man, that's what a good mother does. but my mother, what was really wonderful is that my mother, in her surprise at things, I got to witness the everyday on a different level. It was not just living it, but it was having her reaction to so many things that helped mm-hmm. me to see what it was I was feeling or seeing or hearing or tasting. And it gave me another set of eyes, another voice that was omnipresent. And I think that helped me tremendously. And then on top of that, my mother would tell stories of growing up in England, you know, and she would talk about snow and kings and queens and all that sort. And, you know, as a kid, you think, well, man, that's just all made up. Because I was living in the desert. There's no snow and there's no kings. No king of Arizona, you know, and she did it, though, with such detail and such care and clear feeling that I think storytelling became natural to me, and her eye for small details, that helped me become a poet. That is to say, as a counterpoint to actually experiencing and making my own judgments about things, it gave me a reverberation that I think just helped me tremendously. And she left a lot of linguistic time bombs lying around. I remember I was not a I was a junior in high school, and my school was not a college prep school. So we were in trouble. We were making too much noise, and our punishment in those days was, all right, everybody, stop what you're doing and read. No, anything but that. Right? So we had to get a book, open it up, and start reading, and that was our punishment. I remember reading. I was reading a book, and I got to a line, and I just burst out laughing, and teacher said, be quiet, or whatever. It was such a milestone to me. I couldn't believe what I had just discovered. And the line had a phrase, bloody L, and it was bloody and then apostrophe E-L-L, as in bloody hell, right. A very common British phrase that I did not know. My mother had been saying that all my life. And L, well, you know, that was one more letter of the alphabet. And bloody L, well, you know, kings and queens, they're all getting their heads chopped off. You know, it's just my mother's sense of humor. I never knew she was saying bloody hell until
amazing.
That moment, sitting down on the border in Nogales, reading a book, and I came across that phrase. And it's just one of those things. Things like that, they just are these little explosions.
That's amazing.
The H, like in Spanish, was silent.
it reminds me of I have a cousin who grew up in Layton, which is a little rural Mexican community outside of Fresno.
Uh-huh.
And she moved to England when she graduated college. So she had a child there. And now he's, you know, a boy. And when he comes home, you know, to California, he'll say stuff like, can I have another tortilla?
Tito.
That's right. Well, and actually, when you say my name, Tito, when my mother talks to me, of course, it's Tito.
Oh, yeah. And they've all,
I grew up with that.
Have you always been called Tito, just always your whole life?
Yeah, my father's name was also Alberto, and so Albertito. My grandmother called me Betito, mm-hmm. and that got shortened pretty quickly to Tito. And even though I was a junior, Tito kind of took hold.
Tito's much cooler than Junior.
Absolutely. I think so.
Listen, Tito, every time we have a poet on our show, mm-hmm. we have a segment called Poem of the Week. And so we invite our poet to read a poem, and I have a request.
Yes, absolutely.
Daniel and I both love dogs, and I love your poem, My Dog, That Stranger. Will you read that for us on the air?
I would be very happy to. The genesis of this, we all have had that dog that has passed away. And, you know, the truth is we don't recover.
Right.
And
that's
so
true.
I was just thinking about my dog, you know, my dog. My dog, that stranger, one, fallen, low, pooled, and lurking smells gather at a dog's eye level. Things his eyes do not see, but which his nose guarantees him, are there. Enough to stop him. Scents and molds and rots that make him lurch. Pink blotches of floor sugar calling, hey you, to him. Loud enough for his ears to hear through his nose. His eyes, old things. He knows they mean well, and they try. But his nose is how he sees the world and tastes and hears it. Two. Some loud smells scare him at first, but they call him back. They call his name. How did they know it? They reach out to him, those sirens he cannot resist, even against all impulse toward home. Hey, boy, coolly they say, and he goes. No matter where. And when he goes fast. And when he gets to them, his nose is the first on the scene. It's why dogs have long noses. They can't wait to get where they want to get. 3. But when they get there, they're there, and it's just a smell. All they can do, crazy dogs, is turn in circles. They look up at us after a while to whimper, where did it go, and why? And why did it not take me? The circling stops, finally, and the ears go up when we call, but the way back is slow. As things turn out, urinating on everything in sight did not help. Bereft, eyes up, they come back into consciousness, shaking their head. 4. The ghosts of everything good do not give up, however. They lie in wait up the walk, a wet, prunish mark, an invisible dried sweat, a potato chip. The calm seas newly restored in the soul of the dog, they do not last, not even for a minute. Hey, he hears again through both his nostrils. Those precision instruments wrinkling themselves to the left, then up slightly, unsure at first, then fixed. Hey, you, says a new voice. You! 5. My dog does not belong to me. My dog is not mine every day for a few minutes. For that time, I belong to him, my teacher, that small, wagging grace. I watch the simple and not simple. He smells something from so many centuries past, all in the few seconds of a small moment, that dark joy, smudges on leaves, the beetle shell with ants, old snake. Hey, you, they repeat. Yeah, what? He answers. I wait to hear his news.
It was a beautiful poem, Tito. Thank you for
thank you very much.
And thank you for being our guest today on Words on a Wire.
It has been a total pleasure, and I'm so happy to hear from both of you.